KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A bill to create tribal language immersion schools passed in the recent New Mexico legislative session, as Jeanette Didios reports.
New Mexico has 23 sovereign tribes, and among those tribes, 8 languages are spoken, but only 7 are taught in school districts. Senate Bill 13 would create a 5-year pilot program with 5 schools prioritizing distinct native languages of Tiwa, Tewa, Towa, Karis, Apache, Zuni, and Diné. Bill co-sponsor Democratic Senator Benny Shendo Jr. from Jemez Pueblo says that many Native parents and grandparents have been conditioned to believe that the only way to succeed was to speak English.
But that's not true. I was born and raised speaking my own language. It wasn't much later that I began to learn English. So how can that be when those of us that were fluent Native speakers are able to be successful in college and all the stuff that we're doing today?
He says a lot of Native students are struggling because they don't feel that they belong.
And if we can really reground them in who they are, then I think it gives them that confidence for them to be able to go out and compete in the world in a way that they should be competing, not with anxiety about who am I, where do I belong.
Native American students have historically reported lower achievement and graduation rates than their peers. The New Mexico Indian Education Act stresses the importance of maintaining Native languages and culture, but programs providing these opportunities are currently limited within public schools. The bill does not contain an appropriation, but will provide operational and capital outlay funding for immersion schools. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
A new study shows intimate partner violence disproportionately impacts Indigenous women more than any other ethnic or racial group in the U.S. Judith Ruiz Branch has more.
The murder rate for Native American women and girls is up to 10 times higher than the national average, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, yet they account for less than 1% of the population. Desiree Todi with the Center Against Sexual and Domestic Abuse is a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa in Wisconsin. She says violence against Native women is underreported and unaddressed.
There's jurisdictional issues that come into play as to how things are investigated, how things are tried, and there's always racism. There's less attention paid to the individuals that some of these things happen to.
The Wisconsin Department of Justice created a task force to combat violence against Native women across the state after legislation that would have addressed these issues failed to pass. Poor tracking and data collection are just some of the many issues that contribute to the epidemic amongst Indigenous women. During a multi-state march last month, Todi read a list of names of Indigenous people from Minnesota who had died from domestic violence. No such list currently exists for Wisconsin, and Todi says she's working on changing that. She emphasizes the great need to address the systems in place that continue to fail Native people.
I have 3 daughters that I want them to grow up as strong Native women, and I want them to grow up safely as strong Native women. I mean, this is their futures on the line.
Research shows Indigenous women also face significant barriers when seeking help after experiencing domestic violence. A survivor herself, Todi works to provide resources for those affected in Bayfield and Ashland counties. I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
Tribal flags removed from a Veterans Affairs hospital in Phoenix, Arizona, are now being displayed by the office of Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs. The flags were removed after new rules were issued by the Trump administration on the public display of flags throughout VA facilities. Tribal leaders in the state strongly objected to the removal of the flags by the VA. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
It's vital for Alaskans to know that they're connected to their nation and that what we do in Alaska matters to our nation.
Alaska Public Broadcasting enters the spotlight during a DOGE hearing on NPR and PBS. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 26th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, lawmakers struggle to craft a balanced budget as time ticks away.
I've been trying to impress upon my colleagues that the numbers don't change, but if we don't come up with a solution, it can ruin your summers.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
A federal judge in Anchorage has ruled in favor of Alaska's state-owned investment bank in a lawsuit that could clear the way for oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The Alaska Beacon reports that Judge Sharon Gleason wrote in an order published Tuesday that the U.S. Department of the Interior acted illegally when it canceled oil and gas leases held by the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority on land within the refuge. ADA did not immediately respond to a request for comment, but Corey Mills, Alaska's Deputy Attorney General, called the decision a victory. Tuesday's order was the result of a lawsuit filed by ADA against the federal government last year when the Biden administration canceled oil and gas leases that ADA won in a January 2021 sale. Two other companies also won leases during the sale but later surrendered them to the federal government, leaving ADA as the only company holding leases within the refuge's coastal plain, which is believed to hold significant oil and gas reserves just as nearby state land does. The Biden administration claimed that the sale, conducted under the auspices of the first Trump administration, was flawed and thus illegal. Gleason had upheld the Biden administration's suspension order, but when it came to the cancellation, she ruled in ADA's favor. Several environmental and tribal groups sided with the federal government during the course of the lawsuit and had requested the ability to offer alternative solutions if Gleason ruled in favor of ADA. In a statement released last week, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum said he intends to open the refuge's entire 1.56 million-acre coastal plain to development, indicating that ADA will be given a free hand on its leases. U.S. House Republicans put the top executives of NPR and PBS on the hot seat today, and Democrats used the hearing to spotlight Alaska as an example of the value of public broadcasting. The hearing was one of the first of the House Subcommittee on Delivering on Government Efficiency. The chair of the so-called DOGE panel is Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who says the public broadcasting networks are biased and should not receive public funds.
We will be calling for the complete and total defund and dismantling of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
CPB receives more than $500 million a year from the federal government, most of which goes to local stations. The stations produce local news and programs and pay NPR and PBS to air national content. Democrats on the panel invited Alaska Public Media President Ed Ullman to testify. He said that in many parts of Alaska and the country, public media is the only local outlet for broadcast news and provides critical warnings and alerts during emergencies. Ullman also pointed out that Alaska public media stations produce audio and video stories about Alaskans that air nationally and because of their affiliation with the national networks.
Without PBS, without NPR, you wouldn't hear stories, news stories, public affairs stories, community stories from Alaska. You wouldn't see them on the PBS NewsHour. This is vital. It's vital for Alaskans to know that they're connected to their nation and that what we do in Alaska matters to our nation.
The hearing was mostly focused on Republican complaints about the national networks. NPR President Catherine Marr acknowledged the network was wrong to initially dismiss the importance of certain news stories, such as what was on Hunter Biden's laptop and the theory that the COVID pandemic began with a leak from a Chinese virology lab. State lawmakers are now more than halfway through their four-month legislative session, and time is ticking away. The Alaska House and Senate are both controlled by bipartisan caucuses made up of mostly Democrats. Coming into the session, the two caucuses looked like they were aligned on many key issues. They each said they wanted to boost education funding, improve the state's retirement system, and, of course, pass a balanced budget. But the devil is always in the details, and fractures are starting to show as legislators work toward a final budget. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone is at the Capitol and joins us now to tell us more. Eric, where do things stand in Juneau?
Okay, so Casey, we're coming up at the end of March, and that means the complicated, time-consuming process of writing the budget is well underway. But looming over all of this is the fact that lower oil prices mean that lawmakers are facing deficits. And, you know, unlike the U.S. Congress, the state constitution actually requires the legislature to balance the budget every year. So current estimates for a status quo budget put it hundreds of millions of dollars underwater. So that's basically the same education funding as last year, plus a roughly $1,400 permanent fund dividend. Thing is, though, there is a lot that the majority want to add. The biggest part of that, of course, is the boost to state education funding that the House passed earlier this month. And how to pay for that is not exactly clear.
Yeah. So how could lawmakers pay for that funding boost and balance the budget?
So there are a few different levers that lawmakers could pull to balance the budget. There are three main ones, I would say. They could raise taxes or, you know, find some other revenue. They could draw from a state savings account, or they could cut the permanent fund dividend to balance the budget. Actually, there is a fourth. They could significantly cut back on state services. But, you know, every single one of those is facing opposition from somewhere. I'll go kind of in reverse order here. Budget cuts are on the table, but, you know, some of the key budgeters say that after years of relative austerity, there isn't a whole lot left to cut. House members are talking about, you know, cutting spending somewhere, maybe some of the governor's increases, but it's unclear, you know, where that will land as I talk to you now. Okay, so next, cutting the PFD, that is never popular. In the last couple of years, it's become something of a tradition to have the quarter of the legislature's annual draw from the permanent fund be set aside for dividends. That is, you know, that sort of results in the $1,400 figure I referenced earlier. Senators have been hesitant to go much lower than that. You know, it's a pretty important part of a lot of people's income. But this week, we did see some softening in a news conference. Some key senators expressed some flexibility on maybe reducing the PFD to about $1,000. They've also floated repeatedly cutting back on that education funding boost the House passed. They're floating cutting back on it by about a third. That gets you a lot of the way there to balancing the budget, but, you know, not quite.
Not quite, but you mentioned two other options, raising revenue or taking the deficit from savings. What about that?
Okay, so those are another two where they're kind of at loggerheads here. You know, Senate President Gary Stevens, he's a Kodiak Republican, he said at the beginning of the session that drawing from savings was off the table. He even chastised the editor of the Juneau Empire for asking him about it repeatedly. Well, so this week, Stevens actually apologized to the editor of the Empire, and he said the Senate was, after all, looking at drawing from savings to cover the portion of the deficit that covers the current year. Here's how he put it.
Times change, things change, and sometimes you have to eat crow up here.
But Senator Lyman Hoffman, he's the Finance Committee co-chair in the Senate, he says he doesn't think senators are interested in drawing from savings for the next year. And that's the real meat of the budget. You know, what happens, you know, from July 1st to June 30th. Hoffman and the rest of the Senate majority have been emphasizing revenue bills as a way to pay for, you know, the things that the House and the Senate want to do. There are three major ones in the Senate right now. They're basically changes to oil taxes and corporate income taxes. But again, you know, there is a catch. The House has a one-vote majority. It's 21-19 over there. And just recently, House Majority Leader Chuck Kopp, he's an Anchorage Republican, and he signed on to an op-ed opposing oil taxes that included most of the minority Republicans in the House. So that means that even if every member of the majority voted for all these taxes, and there's no guarantee that they would, they could not pass without some Republican minority help. Kopp says, you know, for his part, he'd like to balance the budget using some of the other mechanisms we just talked about, like, you know, using savings in the Constitutional Budget Reserve or CBR.
Yes, we have to do a CBR draw. Yes, we have to pay the dividend we can afford. No, we don't have to do it by raising taxes on entities and persons. Not this year.
And that is basically where things stand.
Okay, well, how are they going to resolve this?
Well, you know, that's anybody's guess at this point. There is even some special session chatter going around right now. Hoffman, though, the Senate Finance Co-Chair, he says it's unlikely that any extra time would actually result in, you know, some breakthrough.
I've been trying to impress upon my colleagues that the numbers don't change, but if we don't come up with a solution, it can ruin your summers.
Leaders on the House side, for their part, they say nobody's too dug in at this point, and, you know, for that reason, they're optimistic, too. But, of course, we'll have to wait and see.
Yes, we will, and we will keep following your coverage of this. That was Alaska Public Media's Capitol reporter, Eric Stone. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Kenai Peninsula's online farmers market shuts down.
The biggest value that the Food Hub added to our business was to be able to reach outlying communities.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Ready or not, University of Alaska Giving Day is here. Visit givingday.alaska.edu to support UAF, UAA, and UAS students and programs. Double or triple your gift, win exciting prizes, and make a difference through 1 p.m. on March 27th. More at givingday.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Foundation.
An Anchorage woman has been sentenced to 1 year in prison following an investigation into her tax practices. Tina Yee owned and operated Polaris Bar in Nome from 2007 until its closure in 2017 when a fire destroyed the building, killing one resident. According to court documents, between 2014 and 2018, Yee maintained two sets of financial records for the business. One set accurately recorded the business's income and expenses, while the other understated the income. An investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice uncovered a tax loss of over $550,000. Yee pleaded guilty to the charges last July. A Bethel man is among three people recently charged in what federal prosecutors say was a conspiracy to traffic large quantities of the painkiller tramadol to Alaska and across the country in 2024. KYUK's Evan Erickson has more.
In federal court documents, investigators accused 38-year-old Ryan Graydonis of receiving a, quote, significant number of packages containing tramadol sent by two other men named in the indictment, 39-year-old Adil Hussein and 45-year-old Syed Naqvi. Tramadol is an opioid pain medication considered to have fewer adverse effects and less risk of dependency than other prescription painkillers. As a Schedule IV controlled substance, it also has fewer legal penalties for trafficking and is less regulated than other medications that serve similar functions. The federal charges for Graydonis stem from a state case in which he was arrested at the Anchorage Airport en route to Bethel in March of 2024. Authorities say he had more than 1,500 tramadol pills with him at the time. Graydonis ultimately pleaded guilty to misdemeanor drug possession and was sentenced to 2 years of probation in that case. But federal prosecutors and investigators say those pills seized in Anchorage had allegedly been sent from Arizona by Hussein and Naqvi, according to court documents. Federal authorities say they identified more packages containing tramadol sent by the men to Graydonis in Alaska after the 2024 case. The filing does not specify where in Alaska the packages were allegedly sent. In 2024 alone, federal authorities claim that Hussein and Naqvi sent more than 15,000 packages suspected of containing tramadol to locations across the country. The pair was arrested in early March in California, while Graydonis was arrested in Bethel on March 16th. All three have been charged with one count of felony conspiracy to distribute and possess with intent to distribute controlled substances. Graydonis faces two more similar felony charges. The three counts against Graydonis each carry a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. Graydonis was released from federal custody on Monday and was not listed as being in the custody of the state of Alaska as of Wednesday. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
The $44 billion Alaska LNG project picked up a letter of intent last Thursday from Taiwan's state-owned CPC Corporation. The letter is non-binding, but project officials say it's a first step toward a binding agreement to buy gas from the project if it's built. In a joint press conference with Governor Mike Dunleavy, Taiwanese President Lai Ching-te said Alaska gas is conveniently located and a source of high-quality natural gas. In a press release, CPC Corporation said Alaska would become Taiwan's closest source of natural gas if the project is built.
We are very interested in buying Alaskan natural gas because it can meet our needs and ensure our energy security.
Governor Mike Dunleavy called Alaska LNG the state's flagship project, and he said it's more than just an energy initiative.
It is a bridge connecting the future prosperity of both Alaska and Taiwan.
If it's built, the Alaska LNG project would move natural gas from the North Slope to South Central for shipment overseas. The project includes a treatment plant on the slope, an 800-mile pipeline, and a liquefaction facility in Nikiski. U.S. President Donald Trump has been a vocal supporter of the project. As reported by the New York Times, some say recent foreign interest is a result of tariff threats from the White House. To date, no company has signed firm agreements to buy gas from the project, and the state corporation that owns the project declined to provide details about existing letters of intent, including who has signed them and how many there are. Well, the Kenai Peninsula's only online farmers market is no longer in service. The Alaska Food Hub program connected consumers with farmers and distributed locally grown produce to communities across the peninsula. KDLL's Hunter Morrison has more on what that means for the region's food system.
Cook Inlet Keeper, a Homer-based environmental nonprofit, said in January it would sunset the Alaska Food Hub program to shift its focus back to the region's oil and gas industries. That's in part due to President Donald Trump's move to expand drilling in Alaska. The hub was an online platform funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where local farmers and fishermen could sell their goods. Consumers would order and pick up their food items at one of several distribution points across the peninsula, from Soldotna to Seldovia.
You know, it's really loved by the customers who've used it and by all of the vendors that we've helped produce.
That's Lauren Barrett, co-executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper. She says in its heyday, about 40 local farmers and fishermen were part of the program. The food hub was intended to be a two-year pilot program launched in 2016, but blossomed into a nearly decade-long food distribution endeavor. For some farmers, it relieved the burden of setting up at in-person farmers markets.
A lot of them started out like not sure if they were going to be farmers, and now they've got huge full-fledged operations.
For small-scale producers like Jubilee Farms in Soldotna, the Alaska Food Hub was a more convenient way to sell eggs and plant starts. Owner Tina Lagatoris says the program helped her avoid potential pitfalls of farmers markets, like low sales and vendor fees. Plus, she says it only cost her $40 a year to sell through the program.
It was a nice way to do it because it's a lot easier for me personally to sell that than to load everything up and go to a farmer's market and have to sit there all day long, like on a Saturday or something like that in all kinds of weather to sell my product.
Homer-based Twitter Creek Gardens has been involved with the food hub since its inception. The 9-acre farm grows and sells mixed vegetables. Emily Garrity is the farm's owner.
The biggest value that the food hub added to our business was to be able to reach outlying communities because of their delivery service and also probably just marketing outreach because that was built into the program.
Although the food hub was the smallest portion of her farm's sales, Garrity says it helped her reach Kenai Peninsula communities not connected to the road system, like Nanwalik. The native village of about 250 people gets most of its food from shipments out of Homer. According to Cook Inlet Keeper's website, over $25,000 worth of Food Hub products were distributed to community organizations within the last few years. That includes Nanwalik's Elder Tea Program, a once-weekly luncheon for the village's elders. Anthony Brewster is a cook for the Elder Tea Program. He says the Food Hub fed about 50 people in his community.
From my perspective, it was really positive. There was like vegetables I didn't even know grew in Alaska, like the green tomatoes and some other ones. And I thought that was really neat. I have had like radishes and turnips before, but It was nice to have them from somewhere else.
During the pandemic, Brewster says it was difficult for the community to get fresh produce. He says the food hub stepped in 2023. Now, the program will go back to getting its produce from the grocery store. For food producers like Jubilee Farms, the food hub's sunset means one less way to sell its products. Barrett, Cook Inlet Keepers co-executive director, says the region's food network has grown in the last decade. And although the Alaska Food Hub has ended, Barrett says the seeds are still there. She says local organizations and farmers are already talking about the next step in the region's food market. In Kenai, I'm Hunter Morrison.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to healthcare in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
A University of Alaska Fairbanks researcher says her research team's recent study shows electric vehicles could benefit rural communities around the state that are off the road system. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Michelle Wilbur is the lead author of the study. She's a research engineer for UAF's Alaska Center for Energy and Power, and she concedes that the study's premise contradicts a commonly held notion that electric vehicles, or EVs, don't do well during winter in Alaska.
We all know that electric vehicles have lower range and use more energy in the winter. So we started out with the question, is this a good idea?
EVs use a lot of energy stored in their battery to keep it and the passenger compartment warm during cold winter days. That limits the distance that an EV can travel under those conditions, much more than a gasoline or diesel-powered vehicle. That's probably why the researchers got some skeptical feedback about the study, including some from residents of the three communities where it was conducted, Bethel, Kotzebue, and Galena.
We got some fun Facebook posts about people who are very much worried that it's not a good idea.
But Wilbur says the data they collected led researchers to conclude that EVs are actually better suited than gasoline or diesel-powered vehicles for certain uses in the communities.
So we have held a number of community meetings, collected a bunch of data, done a bunch of analysis, and we found out that in most cases that we modeled, it often is a good idea.
The research showed that's largely because operating gasoline or diesel-powered vehicles in cold weather can be costly, especially for those who leave the engine running for a while in the morning to warm it up, or at other times of the day when running errands. And fuel is expensive in rural communities. Diesel costs about $8 a gallon in Kotzebue, about $9 in Galena.
Non-electric cars are using a lot more energy than we thought, it seems, in daily operation. Idling to keep them warm when you keep your car running at the grocery store while you run in and back out because you don't want it to cool down.
The researchers also factored in the cost of plugging in vehicles so their block heater will keep the engine warm enough to start more easily. The communities all have their own power plants, and the diesel that fuels those generators also is expensive, and so is the cost of power.
Plugging the car in overnight into a block heater, especially if you don't have any timer on that or you're not kind of watching how long it's plugged in for, those are using a lot of energy too.
Wilbur says their analysis accounted for other factors, like the ways people use their vehicles. They found that EVs are less expensive to operate than gasoline or diesel-powered vehicles for longer duration uses, like for taxis or deliveries, because the vehicle is on and its battery stays warm.
There are a number of factors that we found can make that a switch to electric even more clearly beneficial. One is longer driving times, because there is energy used to keep the battery of an EV warm, even when it's not being driven.
Similarly, the researchers found that EVs work well for people who commute long distances. But that's not common in rural communities, so Wilbur says the study affirms that not every rural resident would benefit by having an EV. That may be why there's only a few of those in the communities they studied. But she says the paper shows that some potentially would benefit.
It often is a good idea. It often does save people money.
The National Science Foundation-funded study compiled by Wilbur and her team was published last month in the World Electric Vehicle Journal. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Last weekend's T-Dog Sled Dog race brought 39 mushers from across the country to Fairbanks. And as KNOM's Wally Rana tells us, mushers say the race's inclusive spirit sets it apart from other events.
Sarah Richards is no stranger to dog mushing. She founded her kennel Deja Vu Sled Dogs in 2017 and has competed in sled dog races before. But this year, she decided to take on her longest race yet, the T-Dog 200. Beyond the challenge of a longer race, she says she chose the T-Dog for its unique vibe.
It kind of encompasses the spirit of mushing and brings back some of that, some of those components that maybe get lost in more competitive races.
A highlight for Richards was interacting with mushers along the trail. Mushers she had known through social media but hadn't met in person.
Being able to talk with other mushers and get to know them a little bit more, you know, people that maybe I've been Facebook friends with for years or whatever but haven't ever met, that was really great.
Joining Richards on the trail was Jessica Lemire, who moved to Nome 5 years ago and runs Comstock Kennel with her husband. She says she got lost about 70 miles into the race near Old Minto.
Seems funny because Old Minto is not very big, but despite that, I think somehow that is still kind of one of my favorite moments.
Lemire says the unexpected adventure added tens of miles to her race, prompting her to scratch at the Nanana checkpoint.
Dog care is the most important thing, and my dogs being happy and having a good time and having fun is the most important thing to me.
Richards' race had an unexpected twist, too. She says she picked up a knee injury just before crossing the Fairbanks finish line.
Tipped my sled a little bit, put a leg out, and my knee just popped. I wasn't able to stand up. Basically, my knee was collapsing on me.
The diagnosis? A full ACL tear. Despite the accident, she says she was proud to receive an award for taking exceptional care of her team.
Winning the Vet Choice Award is the biggest honor that I could possibly ask for, even far above like actually winning a race or anything like that.
Nome's Cami Cab Warland also joined in on the race. She wears two hats. She's an optometrist and a dog musher.
It's a lot. It's a lot to work, you know, at least 8 hours a day or traveling to the villages. And then also training for this race was a challenge. In a normal year, just getting the hours in would be tough enough.
Like her fellow residents of Nome, she said she enjoyed the friendly interactions on the trail.
It was also a lot of fun spending time in the checkpoints, just kind of hanging out with everybody to talk to them, talk about our dogs, you know, things mushers usually do.
The T-Dog had its first official event in 2024. It was created by Trailbreaker Kennels Tekla Butcher Munson. She's the daughter of four-time Iditarod champion Susan Butcher and Yukon Quest champion Dave Munson. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Wally Rana.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Eric Stone in Juneau, Ben Townsend and Wally Rana in Nome, Evan Erickson in Bethel, Ashlyn O'Hara and Hunter Morrison in Kenai, and Tim Ellis in Delta Junction. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night. Slip sliding away.
Slip sliding away. Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GCI, providing telecommunication services to tribal health organizations and nonprofit rural health providers, enabling telehealth services for Alaskans. More at gci.com/healthcare.
Matson, delivering the essentials for everyday life in the last frontier. Learn more at matson.com/Alaska.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
You're such a nice guy, you're faithful, you don't lie. After the club, you go back home, right? Right,
Just my dick, you fucking suck.
can suck, man. I hope that your heart get hit by a semi truck. So suck my head. Fucking suck, man.
I hop in your whip and take a sip, then I gun it. I don't got much self-control. I hope that you running. I'm bipolar with the switch up just as quick like you coming. I don't got much self-control. I hope that you running.
I'm not a cheater, but if I'ma be accused, might as well be. You tell me you'll take me back when hell freezes, but females be washing me outside my telly. Temptation overwhelms me, like my monthly bill from Sprint. They're charging me for a selfie. Charging me, so I gave my hotel key. Just trying to be nice.
You're such a nice guy, a nice guy. You're faithful, you don't lie. After the club, you'll go back home, right? Right,
sigh, suck my dick. You fucking suck, man. Suck my dick. You fucking suck, man. I hope that your heart get hit by a semi truck. Suck my dick. You fucking suck, man.
I'm getting music while you suffer like I'm Carmichael Fuller. You tied up in the basement while I chill on your sofa. La próxima yo sé que mejor me quedo sola. Estás de buenas que yo ya vendí mi pistola.
I'm an emotional wreck. Affects me. When you joke, it upsets me. You say I'm no good at sex and you think I'm gross and unsexy. I need scope cause my breast stinks. You hope I choke on a Pepsi. Yep, you were supposed to correct me. Been texting you since 3. I still get no fucking reply. You say you sleep alone, but yet your mattress is king size. Also, you going in those knee-high boots, cut it out. Which I doubt that you're going to house it in that outfit, no skin-tight Levi's. Every word that comes out your mouth's a fucking lie. Oh, it's springtime, time for you to have a fling like a slingshot. You say don't come over cause you got pink eye, but I think I got just the thing. Why don't I bring my fucking bat and just swing by?
What's your definition of it? How's it make you feel? Tell me what you say that truly makes it real. Kings and queens, philosophers have tried so hard to find. Tell me what it means to you, dear, never mind. Love is kind when the world is cold. Love stays strong when the fight gets old. Love's a shoulder to lean on, love is you. Love's like the water when the well runs dry. Quench my thirst, keep me alive. Just need one sip, baby. Love is you. 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 Is it possible there is a kiss that's so divine? Or am I just a fool? Is it all in my mind? Is there something chemical a scientist might say? Well, love must be a drug to make me feel this way. Cause love's my permission to be who I am. No inhibitions cause you understand. Freedom to breathe, oh baby, love is you. Love's like a kiss when the sun goes down. Holds me tight when no one's around. Love's what I wanna hold on to. Love is you. 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 Makes me stronger. I don't have to look no longer. You're the one I cling to. Love is you. When the chips are down, love will stick around. Oh, I'm so glad I found love is you. Much as I've tried to clarify, love's quite simple, he's just my guy. A perfect definition, love is you. Love is you. Love is yours. Love is yours. Love is yours.
this old woman, she was hard as nails. I think she just come out of the county jail. But I loaned her some money just to pay her rent. If I would, she would put me in her last will and testament. Well, I got lots of children, an ex-wife or two.
Real hard.
It's so hard.
Real hard.
It's that hard.
It's
The Yunga Tribal Council is a proud sponsor of KSDP and Aleutian Peninsula Broadcasting. Thank you for your support.
It's a beautiful, beautiful life.